preamble. I've been here for a week, so I've been talking about socialism for a week. I've been discussing this from different angles, and I sort of have a plan. One of the conditions that is imposed by this format is that each session has to stand alone, so it has to be interesting in its own. And the other thing is that that some people repeat, some people come back several times, so I cannot repeat the same thing because then it would be boring to those people. So I'm sandwiched between those two constraints, and so I'm kind of discussing socialism from different angles, and some of these things may not seem like directly connected to the issue, but actually I will contend that it is all connected, one way or another. So let me get you a little bit up to date where I'm at with the people who are repeating here. I have made a proposal that we should look at socialism not so much as a certain model or a certain configuration of society to which socialists want to conform our social structures, right? In other words, you know, we shouldn't think of this. I mean, it is part of it. It's part of socialism, but we shouldn't mainly think of socialism as a society that has this or that characteristic. Like, for example, collective management over productive resources, etc. But I think that it's better to think of socialism as a response. As a response by people to the extent that they are victimized, right? As a response against the conditions that exist in society. Because those conditions, to some extent, large or small, that's how it feels to us, degrade our humanity, offend us, aggravate us one way or another. And then we react to those conditions, and that reaction is what I call socialism, except that socialism is a reaction that is radical. In other words, it's not a reaction against the symptoms, you know, the superficial apparent phenomena that, you know, that is oppressive to us and it bothers us, but the roots or the sources of those phenomena. We try to look dig deeper and go after those sources to uproot those sources, and thereby eliminate the problem. And in the previous sessions, we came up with the notion of describing the social conditions in terms of what Marxists and some social scientists call alienation, social alienation. Alienation, it's a term that is used in psychology, like to refer to people who cannot control their thoughts or their emotions and have a hard time doing that to some extent. But here is in the sense of a societal or a social problem rather than an individual psychological one. And it's more like hardened, it's more rooted, it's not something that you can eliminate just by changing your hand, it's something that you have to eliminate by changing the social structures, changing the way we are organized to go about, you know, the business of life. Social alienation, the way we described it here before, is this phenomenon where the things that we produce, the wealth that we produce, including the society that we create, the kind of society that we build, escapes our control, becomes kind of autonomous from us, becomes independent from us, and it turns against us. And this is something that is very clear in the political system. You know, when we feel that the political system is, like, for example, now it feels like it's in a sort of gridlock and it's kind of moving in that direction where we don't want it to move. And the same with the economy. When the economy is doing these strange things that crush people, crush individuals, and that it seems like we cannot control it. We as individuals seem to be powerless to affect the economy, to influence the economy, to steer it in a certain way. And that clearly offends us, that clearly aggravates us. And there is something inherent to our humanity in that response, because we as a species, and you know, it's entirely possible that we are different from the rest of the animal kingdom in that our difference with the rest of the animal kingdom are not as large as people used to think, say, in the 19th century or the 20th century, right? Research is showing that, you know, some animals are capable of doing, you know, some things that we thought were exclusive of human beings, but now we know that they are not. But whatever, there is still something specific about the human race, and that has to do with the fact that we problematize the world. We problematize the world. It seems that we engage the world in a purposeful manner, right? That's what sociologists and economists call labor, right? Labor is that purposeful activity. We cannot see a, you know, garbage in the street without immediately visualizing a clean street, you know, a functional urban environment. And then, you know, we see that separation between what is and what should be as a problem that needs to be solved, right? We have to go from here to there, right? And then we also, to the extent that we feel that we are the owners of that situation, right? That we, to the extent that we appropriate that situation, then we feel this sense of like passion, right? If it is not our thing, right? If it is, for example, you know, in a society where private ownership prevails and where private ownership has shaped up our beliefs, you know, if that's the garbage in the, you know, the backyard of my neighbor, then it's not precisely my garbage, even though it does offend me, but it doesn't offend me the same way as garbage in my own backyard, right? So, like, but then, you know, we have this passion. It's a passion because it's something that you suffer. You know, you're kind of the victim of that passion. You feel compelled to take action. And that is what I mean by socialism. You know, it's like when society sucks, right? And you just like want to go after the roots of that, you know? It's like you question the political system, you question your leaders, but you are not only questioning, you know, the policies of the leaders, of who the specific individual that is representing you that you hate because he's doing the wrong thing for you, but you question leadership altogether. Why should human beings be divided between leaders and followers? Why not have a horizontal society? Like, you go like all the way, right? Now, can you realize, or can society realize that ideal? I don't know, right? It's problematic, right? You have to solve a bunch of problems if you want to get there. And probably we won't get there, or I don't know. I don't want to answer that question because I don't have an answer to that question. Anyways, so those are the kind of things we've been talking about, but what I want to talk about today is about how the expansion of our productive powers. Oh, let me backpedal a little bit. We made a distinction in previous sessions between those aspects of human life that are inherent to us, or that we simply cannot abolish, that we have to manage one way or another. We have to manage. It's what some Greek philosophers call nature versus convention. It's like this distinction between nature and nurturance, right? The things that we cannot change are natural to us. For example, our human nature. Regardless of what we think our human nature really is, right? There are certain aspects of human life that are just inherent to us because we are just a piece of nature. We are a self-reflective piece of nature, but we are a chunk of nature, just detached from the rest of nature, a kind of counterpose to it. And to that extent, you know, to the extent that we are physical beings, a piece of nature, right? We have to understand our nature, and we have to manage our human nature one way or another, right? But there are other aspects of our life that where we have more freedom, where we have greater room for building social structures, or for building ourselves in ways that are consistent with our, you know, best aspirations, our best dreams, and also consistent with our human nature. And so we made that distinction. Marxists talk about the material aspects of social reproduction versus the social aspects of the reproduction of a society. Material aspects, the things that are invariable that you cannot change. Social aspects, those that you can change. And things that you take for granted, or things that we take for granted because we are so used to seeing them, and we may think that they are institutions that are inherent to us, like markets, like governments, etc. Actually, they are relatively recent in human history, right? If humans have been on Earth for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, as appears to be the case, then only in the last 15,000 years ago, we have the evidence of the first state, the first civilization with the state, with markets, etc. So it's a relatively recent social institutions that nowadays we can, it's very hard for us to imagine. Our political imagination constrained by that, by those beliefs. We believe that how could we manage without markets? How could we manage without government? Right? It seems that only the Tea Party can envision us without government, right? But the rest of us seem to have a hard time thinking about that. Well, anyways. To the extent that this was another long discussion we had, right? To the extent that our productive powers, our understanding of how nature functions, including how our human nature functions, right? To the extent that that expands, those powers, that freedom, right? That freedom expands, then we are able to shape up our social institutions, our social structures. So this is about how historically, like in the last few centuries, especially in the last few centuries, how our productive powers have expanded, right? We also had a previous discussion where we talk about, you know, wealth and how the definition of wealth in a society is something that shifts. It's not something that is fixed once and forever, but it's something that shifts. Like, for example, I think that environmentalists, like John's recent discussion here, to the extent that I know what it was about, right, has to some extent succeeded in persuading a great deal of society to change our definition of wealth. What we think of, when we think of wealth, what we think about, right? Wealth is not only stuff. Wealth, you know, if we define wealth as whatever enhances our welfare, well, our well-being, or our powers, or our capacities, or our freedom, then clearly, you know, a pristine wilderness may be, a deliberate product that we want to make, we want to create by omission, right? That means by not, you know, destroying the environment, but it's something that we have to think of as a product that we want. Otherwise, it's not going to happen the way things are going. By the way, you know, just since I'm talking about freedom and about powers, this is another way in which we can envision or think about socialism. Socialism as a process that builds social structures that are more conducive to the expansion of our human powers and our human freedom, in the sense of giving us more room for us to improve ourselves, right? To produce ourselves as better human beings, as, you know, in whichever direction, in many directions that we may want to develop ourselves. And what are the things that curtail our freedoms? Well, in the first place, clearly, you know, the natural laws, the laws of physics, the laws of biology, right? I cannot just jump off a building and fly, right? Because I cannot do that. There is the law of gravity. So I have to circumvent it. I have to figure out, like, ways. I have to use technology, etc., to circumvent it. But that means that I need a greater understanding of the laws of nature, of the laws of physics, etc., to be able to be more powerful, right? To be freer in that sense. But it's not only nature that constrains us, right? It's also each other or one another. We are in the way of one another. right? And then we need to, if we want to expand our freedom, we want to expand our powers, we need to build social structures where we stand out of the way of one another. So we can think of socialism as a society where, you know, actually this is what Marx, Karl Marx, the German revolutionary, wrote with his friend Friedrich Engels. He said that, you know, communism, that was the term that he used at that time, in 1847, 1848, when they published the Communist Manifesto, he said, communism is a society where the free development of each individual, when the free development of each is the premise or the precondition for the free development of everybody. So, you know, Marx was a libertarian in that sense, believing individual freedom, individual liberties. So building socialism means building social institutions where we stand out of each other's way to the extent possible. And, or another way to put it is where we cooperate with one another in such a way that we help each other to be freer and more productive, right? Okay, so now I'm going to talk about, and I hope to do this very quickly so that I elicit conversation from you, about historically in the last few centuries how the productive powers of human beings have expanded. And I think that we can talk about these processes that, or this, yeah, these processes that, that happen in the productive power of labor. First, the definition of labor, I said, you know, purposeful human activity, right? And labor is one of the is the process that guides and regulates production, the making of goods, the making of wealth, whatever our definition of wealth may be. Now, to accomplish a purpose, labor has to be split. Even if it's just, you know, yourself frying an egg, you know, you have to go like step by step, right? So that means that labor is going to be divided. One step is going to be grabbing the egg from the refrigerator. Step number two is going to be like breaking it. Step number three is going to be like scrambling it, etc. Right? So you have to split labor. Labor exists divided, exists as separate tasks. Right? Even again, even if it is a single individual labor process, one person doing something, over time you are cooperating with yourself, right? You are putting the pan with the oil. And then, you know, you are cooperating with yourself over time because you are scrambling the egg, and then you are doing the next step, the next step, the next step, until you have your fried egg in front of you and ready to be eaten. So labor exists, always split, and also split by individuals. I invite you to think of labor as the purposeful activity of the totality of human beings today. Right? And it's engaged in what? It's engaged in producing wealth. Ultimately, is engaged in producing ourselves, right? Us are the ultimate product. And we, by the way, are also the first input, right? It's us and nature, right? We use chunks of nature, we transform them into wealth. But, you know, we are one of the primary sources of this process. So we're using humanity to produce humanity. The input is humanity plus nature. The output is humanity, plus garbage. So at the end of the day, right, we have to unite the labor that exists fragmented, that exists separated, that is divided. So it's this division of labor. In society, for example, in a modern society, we have laborers divided by function, like. There are certain functions. For example, you know, to produce the experience of having dinner in our dining hall here in Holden Village, right? A lot of things have to happen, but that, you know, there are different functions. For example, some of those functions are planning. Let's call them high functions, right? The functions of planning and organizing, the scheduling, you know, the people who are gonna do the dishes, the people who are gonna do, who are gonna make the pizzas, etc., all that, right? And then the execution, right? It's another function. right? And it may reside in different people, or maybe reside in the same people, or people may rotate, etc. Right? So you have function, age. This is one of the perhaps one of the first in human history, perhaps one of the first reasons why labor was divided. You know, clearly babies are useless. I mean, as as workers, as producers, right? They don't help much. So that means that, you know, they that by age there is a natural division of labor. Sex, for example, you know, the reproductive functions of males and females are different. So, you know, that's gonna. Which, by the way, we should distinguish, and this is one of the cases where we have to distinguish between the material or natural aspects of human life from those that are social, from those that are, you know, that we can shape up. One thing is to talk about sexual differences, and another thing is to talk of patriarchalism or sexism or gender oppression or things like that. That's a social institution that just as we make it, we cannot make it, right? I'm not saying that it's easy to unmake those things, but if we make them, we can unmake them. The sexual differences, that is the result of natural evolution. That may be, we are working on that, obviously. You know, when you think about all this work that's being done on the, you know, the, what is that, the human genome, etc. Occupation, etc. So, let me go faster here. So every time that you reunify labor that exists is split, because you have to unify it to produce, for example, the experience of having dinner in the hall. You have to combine all these individual efforts into a single stream that produces that output. That process is cooperative. And cooperation requires that we share, at the very least, a purpose, an idea. You know, that purposeful thing in the definition of labor, that's what I'm talking about. So corporations require that workers share productive inputs. For example, you know, we share the land. When we are in the doing the dishes there in the kitchen, right? We share the space. We share the you know, some of the devices that we have there, etc. I just did the dishes. That's why I'm bragging that. And now, to the extent that the need, the social need, this is a theorem as attributed to Adam Smith. You know, that the extent of the social of the division of labor is determined by the size. Smith said the size of the market, but what he really meant is the size of the social need. Like, for example, here, if we have the need for, you know, we use so many dishes, cups, etc., that, you know, it starts to make sense for us to have a pottery shop here to produce our own pottery, right? So, you know, to the extent that if we were going to use just a cup every now and then, we break it every now and then it doesn't make sense for us to have a pottery to produce our pots, right, or our cups. Well, we better acquire it through cooperation with someone who produces those items. We can buy it, for example, in the market, or, you know, we can have a friend who, you know, will give us that as a gift. And then, to the extent that we can, divide labor and specialize, because to the extent that you can split labor process in its small parts, you can study it better and you can become better at it. You can specialize people on those functions. This is what usually economists mean by division of labor. So division of labor in the sense that an allocation of these different separate aspects of a labor process such that we can specialize tools and human beings, producers, workers, in particular functions. And then also freeing time to save labor. And for example, developing roundabout ways to produce more. For example, machines, right? A machine is a device that has these parts at least. It has an engine, so it has a motive force that is gonna move it. It has a transmission mechanism, and it has a tool or a set of tools that is going to operate on the object of labor. And the simple tools are moved by humans or by animals. The advanced tools will be moved by other sources of energy. And clearly, mechanization builds on labor division and cooperation, the introduction of machines. And then automation, you know, automata, the plural of automaton, they are machines, but they are machines that are regulated by a control system. Right? It uses information technology and stuff like that. And then modern information technology is digital, which gives us a lot of flexibility. You know, as they say, you know, binary people only believe that there are only two types of people: those who understand computers. Yeah. So all of this, all of these steps that I have described so far, correspond to historical periods in the expansion of the modern productive forces of society, and it's, for the most part, it's something that has been associated with capitalism, you know, with the Industrial Revolution in Europe and then in the rest of the world, and with the expansion of capitalism, and to a lesser extent with the socialist experiments in, you know, China and Soviet Union, etc. So how do the productive power, our productivity, expands? Well, productivity can be measured by, you know, the ratio of output to input. Right, the more wealth we produce with the less productive wealth that we use, the more productive we are. Right, so if we want to expand our productive powers, we have to increase our output while holding our inputs constant, or we have to decrease our inputs and produce the same level of output. An example that I came up with used yesterday was this one of clearing a road. So I'm going to use that as the example. Now, don't be deceived by the simplicity of this example. Actually, this example can be scaled up. You know, no matter how complex a labor process is, I think that these aspects are going to hold. So this is kind of just an illustration, but it's also, you know, an abstract representation that applies to many. Virtually to any type of production, I would claim. For example, you know, suppose that there are rocks blocking the way, blocking the road, and we need to clear the road, right? Like suppose one single individual comes, and suppose that the rocks are heavy enough that one single individual doesn't have the strength to move it. So you can have 100 individuals each in taking turns, right, trying to push the rock. Nothing is going to happen to that rock. So the output is going to be zero, right, in terms of whichever way we measure our ability to clear the road, right? The product is going to be a clear, clean road where cars or trucks can pass by. So we need, at the very least, right, to share. We're going to need more than one individual. We're going to need a few people to push the rocks out of the way, and we're going to need to share the space. We're going to need to share the road, so that's going to be an input. It's clearly an input for the whole process of producing a clear, clean road. We need a road in the first place, which in this case it starts with rocks in it. But we are going to share the road. We're going to stand there, and then we're going to share the rocks, right? Like, for example, one individual may push on this side, the other individual on the other side, etc., right? So we're going to have to share the rock. The other key input here is going to be, of course, labor power. We don't have tools. I'm assuming that we don't have tools. So now the labor power, one way or another, is going to have to share the purpose, right? We're going to have to share the idea. What we want to attain is a clear road. So the individuals that are participating in this labor process are going to have to share that purpose. How is that going to happen? I don't know. Maybe one individual is the first one to have the idea, and then he communicates it with the other individuals, which presupposes that these individuals can talk, and they share the same language, right? One way or another, they can communicate. You see, language is kind of an input of this process, implicit, is because it's embodied in the abilities of the worker, right? But language is a product of, you know, a long history of human evolution and it's a human history. So all that is presupposed here, right? We have to have a common language. If you speak Chinese, I speak Spanish, you speak English, maybe, well, with body language, right? But we will find a way to communicate it in order to have a common purpose. Okay, the purpose or the design or the idea, including how to mix the productive inputs, how to combine labor and road and rocks to clear the road, that is what economists call technology. That's what economists call technology. It's like a cooking recipe, has the ingredients, and it also has the how to mix them up. So quickly, I'm gonna try and help you envision different scenarios. For example, one road, four rocks, one worker. Nothing happens, the output's zero. Now, so how are we expanding our productive power from one to two? Well, because in the second case, we have two workers. And then when the two workers at once push the rock, now the rock can be pushed to the side, to the ditch, right? And so now we have expanded our productivity. If we have four workers, we can do this in the same period of time, right? We can move more rocks. If we have more workers, we can move all the rocks in the period of time, and then we may have even like redundant time, right? Which can be used, for example, to go and find a lever or something to move the other rocks. Right? You see what I mean? That now it is possible to mechanize the process, to introduce a simple machine or something to mechanize the process. So something that is important to note is that all products that we create, all the products, a clear road, a road where cars or trucks can circulate, has a physical form, but is an idea that started in the head of at least one of the producers, one of the workers, and it was then implemented in reality. So the products are physical in appearance, but they are ideal in content, right? Just talking to you this morning, I think we were talking about apples, right? How apples embody so much information nowadays, right? How you know, they contain so much science. Until recently, I didn't know that that they use some sort of metallic paper or something to cover the grass under the trees of the apples. I learned that in Wenatchee, on the way here. Right, and now they put something that is reflective so that the sun can hit the that material and then bounce back the light and then redden the apples uniformly so that people find them more attractive, right? So and also that they cut, you know, they remove the little apples, they remove, they try to keep them at a certain space from each other so that they can grow, you know, better, more flavorful, etc. So it seems like the same apple, right, that we used to produce with much less scientific information content, but it's a completely different apple because this one, today's apples are embody a greater amount of human knowledge, human, by the way, knowledge, right, which is another product, exists in some physical form. It always has to exist in either our brains, right, which are physical, or exist in the form where we are communicating our idea to someone else. It's acoustic waves, or ink and paper, or a hard disk, or it's going to have some physical medium of support. Ideas have to have always a physical medium of support, and also products that we usually don't think of as ideas, like for example a truck, they are ideas embodied there. There is a lot of science embodied in a truck. So I will finish with these remarks. Cooperation that requires that at least one of the inputs be shared. There is a term, jargon in economics, in modern economic theory, is called non-rivalry, which means precisely that. It means non-rivalry. Rivalry means this. Means that I have an apple here. I eat it. You cannot eat it. Pizza slice. I eat it. You cannot eat it. Now, if you have a full pizza, right? You have a full pizza. You can eat. I can eat. 7-8 people can eat, but then it's going to be congested, right? So that good or that input would be congestible, right? So it's non-rivalrous up to a point, but then it becomes congested or exhaustible. Those are different terms that economists use. So non-rivalry, the property of non-rivalry goods, this is something that the first Nobel Prize in economics, Paul Samuelson, discovered. He published a paper in 19, I think that was after he had, that's easy to Wikipedia or Google. But it's Paul Samuelson, The Pure Theory of Public Finance. That's the title of that paper, where he discovered that goods that are non-rivalrous are costly to exclude. What does excludability mean? This is another jargony word, right? Excludability means the ability to enforce private ownership rights. Right? If you have a small, if you have an apple, then it's easy for you to protect it because you can keep it in your possession and somebody will have to snatch it from you almost like violently, right? For that person to consume it without your consent. Right? Whether you like giving it to that person or without you selling it to that person. Right? And however you have an orchard, right, then it's more costly, right? You have to fence it, you have to build a fence around it, and then you have to supervise, you know, put an alarm or SIM system or something, right? So the more non-rivalrous an input in general, a good is, the more difficult it is to exclude it. In other words, society will have to spend more and more resources to enforce private ownership rights. This is something that economists that are not socialists, that are not leftists, have figured out. That means that there are limits to markets, there are limits to private ownership, because markets presuppose private ownership. Right? A market is where people who own privately certain items go to in order to exchange those items. If you don't own that, how can you exchange it? It's not yours. You have to own it in the first place to exchange it. But the problem with goods that are non-rivalrous is that it becomes increasingly harder and harder. That means that more and more resources, more and more human labor have to be spent just protecting social institutions, the institution of private ownership, right, from people. This is something that is very clear nowadays with information technology, but I'm going there actually. Ideas, which is the subjective content of all products, are absolutely non-rivalrous. Right? My favorite example is the Pythagoras theorem. You can use the Pythagoras theorem, I can use the Pythagoras theorem, nothing happens to the Pythagoras theorem. Right? The road, right? You can use the road, I can use the road, but if many of us use the road at the same time, then it gets congested, right? Or a swimming pool or a public park. But an idea doesn't suffer that kind of situation, right? You can use it, I can use it, everybody can use it, as long as we are capable of appropriating that piece of knowledge and using it, then everything is fine, nothing happened to that idea, right? That means that to the extent, this is just something that follows very clearly from this, right? To the extent that ideas or the ideal content of the wealth that we produce expands, right? To the extent that ideas gain a greater and greater role, then the institutions of capitalism, right, which is capitalism is based on private ownership, is based on markets, start to fail. I think it follows very clearly from that. Right? Now the physical form of the products makes them at some point rivalrous. Right? Now, to the extent that we can produce more of something, or to the extent that we can reduce people's preference for that, right? That means that, for example, we cannot make a bigger jacuzzi. But, you know, the preferences of people here change because, you know, the weather changes or something, then it's not much of a problem. It won't get congested. Right? So it can be either by expanding the size of the jacuzzi or by people limiting their appetite for jacuzzi. Right? So the only way to make products temporarily non-rivalrous is by making them bigger or producing them more of them. That, by the way, goes to show that to the extent that that there is more scarcity, and to say that there is more scarcity is simply to say that our productive powers are less, right? Because if our productive power, the reason why trips to the moon are scarce is because it's very costly to produce a trip to the moon, right? The reason why raw oil, crude oil, is scarce, right? There is a limited amount of crude oil in the earth. The reason why it's scarce is because we don't have yet a workable technology that would allow us to produce crude oil. It took nature, you know, millions of years to produce the oil that exists in the earth. Are we going to be able to produce oil? And yet we are trying, right? Like some of us learned with the Renita's presentation on the Alberta tar sands experience, right? How, you know, they are taking sand and they saying, oh, that's oil. And they are like using all sorts of tricks to try to extract little bits, little drops of oil out of, you know, yeah, goo. Okay, and I think I'm almost done. This is my last slide here. And you will have 20 minutes to talk. Ideas which always exist in some physical form need to be produced. They need to be mentally manipulated, stored, and they're going to be stored in some physical medium, transmitted through some physical also medium, received. The reception is very important, right? The reception is very important because the receptor has to have the ability to decode the information. Otherwise, the information is going to be useless at the other end. And then the ideas have to be used. So now, as the ideas, technology to produce ideas, to manipulate ideas, to store ideas, to transmit ideas, to receive ideas, and to use them improves, then the non-rivalry of inputs and of goods in general is going to tend to dominate. That means that the excludability or private ownership or markets are going to have a harder time. And they are going to fail in our faces more and more. Even under the most ideal conditions, private ownership markets cannot handle non-rivalrous inputs or non-rivalrous goods in general in an efficient manner. By efficient, I mean making good use of our humanity, right? Which is the thing, the ultimate resource that we have that we don't want to waste. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could say more about this idea of ideas being non-rivalrous. And then you made this comment, and I think that one of those last bullets was addressing it as well, that as ideas, which are non-rivalrous, expand, capitalist social institutions or capitalist institutions begin to fail, you said, or I guess at the end there you said it, they don't handle things efficiently. Do you say more about what you mean there and give examples of that?
Okay. If let's think, for example, of music. Right? Just the economics of that, right? The economics of music production and distribution. Right. The difficult part for a producer of music is producing the first CD. Right. The one that contains the melody or the, you know, the piece of music produced, right? The replication of that, the cost of replicating that is relatively low nowadays. Well, actually, if you take into consideration all the costs for society of producing plastic, right? Which is it plastic that is used to produce CDs? So actually, it may be more expensive than currently people think, right? But you know, but even in that case, I think that you could fairly say, because you don't have to use CDs. You can stream it on the internet, which I think, if you take into consideration all the social cost and benefit, it probably would be relatively cheap. The point being that, you know, the second version of the same piece of music, the third version, the nth version, is going to be marginally expensive compared to the first one that you have to do. The same with movies, right? So if you are in a capitalist society, right, and you are the Hollywood tycoon, right? You make movies, you commercialize movies. Then you obviously do it for profit. You are not doing it in order to bring satisfaction and entertainment or, you know, education to people. You are doing it for profit. So if you invest your capital with the expectation of recovering it with a profit. And so if your movie is going to be copied through the internet by people who are not going to have to pay for it, then that's going to be bad for you. You are not going to be able to recoup, you know, your capital with a profit, or maybe, but not to the extent that you could if you were able to enforce your private ownership rights. So that means that society is going to have to, and I say society because, you know, even though people think that private Tea Party people, right, may think that private ownership has to do just with individuals, actually, private ownership, the way it was introduced in the first historical case that is known, which is the ancient Greece, you know, when the reforms that were introduced by Solon were passed, you know, he pushed for private ownership. He said, like, you know, people have to be made responsible for their piece of land. You know, farmers have to be responsible for their piece of land, for their animals, and so we have to stipulate legally, we have to have a code of private ownership. And then at a point, you know, the experiment had some problems, and he had to abolish debt, because some people got a lot of debt, and some people, you know, something not that dissimilar from what we experienced recently in the United States. A lot of people acquire a lot of debts, you know, under the legislation that existed, and then other people were the lenders, the creditors, other people were the debtors, and then there was a crisis, and then Solon said, let's forgive all the debts, let's go back to what we had before. So we kind of pushed the reset button and redistribute wealth just like that, you know, basically in favor of the poor who had borrowed a lot and against the rich who had lent a lot. But, you know, back to why this non-rivalry makes the enforcement of private ownership more costly to society. I think that example is pretty clear, right? Which is nowadays a dominant topic in the, you know, for all sorts of media, right? All sorts of media are now complaining about how the old business model has been eroded by the internet technology and all that, right? Now, it is possible to devise technologies, but that means that society has to spend a lot of its resources coming up with, you know, it's like making locks, right? Making locks to protect property. And instead of, you know, producing things that people enjoy, you are producing things that are to protect the things that people enjoy. So it's increasingly costly. When the production of the cost of producing the lock gets to be comparable to the benefit of enforcing private ownership rights to the value of the good, then that at that point private ownership has failed, because it doesn't make sense for society to spend more defending property that is not worth as much.
That's the law of diminishing returns.
It is the law of diminishing returns for the law of diminishing returns for the application of resources to protecting private ownership. Or, you know, because the law of diminishing returns appears as the law of increasing cost.
Yeah.
It becomes increasingly costly to enforce private ownership. This is a more general, actually, problem for markets, something that economists since early in the 20th century identified. There was a British economist, Alan Young, who and also another economist, more famous, Alfred Marshall. Alfred Marshall noticed that markets function well when all the costs and all the benefits were incorporated in the calculation that is made by the private producer. Like, for example, say that you produce, this is the example that we used this morning, right? Say that you produce a beautiful garden, you know, in the front of your house, right? So this is a society of private owners. So why do you produce a beautiful garden in front of your house? Well, because you enjoy it, right? So you receive benefits. So you put the benefits here, and then you put the costs here. It takes time, it takes resources for you to, you know, grow your little garden there and to keep it. Right now, are these all the benefits that you and your family enjoy the garden? No. There are people who pass by and enjoy the garden as well. But you don't have a system to collect money from them so that they compensate you, right, for the benefit that they receive from you. There is no market for that. This is called an externality, right? Some of you may, or most of you may know about that term, right? It's an externality. It's an external benefit to those people who are going to enjoy your garden for free. And then as a result, you are going to be, the incentive for you to produce a beautiful garden is going to be less than if the full benefit that society receives, including you and your family, right? If the full benefit were compensating the cost, then people would be more inclined to produce beautiful gardens. You know, your neighbor is benefiting, the value of the house of the neighbor is going to increase because now there is a neighbor that has a beautiful garden. I mean, there are many benefits that other people are going to enjoy, and they are going to enjoy them for free. And since they enjoy them for free, then you don't feel fully compensated, so you underproduce beauty. Right? On the other hand, and this is something that the discussions on the environment have made it very clear, if you produce something like a chemical good, right, and then you know you also produce pollution in the air that somebody is going to breathe, you know, that person has no way to collect, you know, compensation from you. You are harming that person. You are imposing a cost on that person. It's an external cost on those people, but you are not paying for it. So you are only calculating, you know, your private benefits versus your private cost. And since the entire cost is not included in your calculation, you are going to overproduce whatever you are producing, and you are going to overproduce also pollution. So basically, a system of markets, when there are externalities, is going to underproduce beauty and it's going to overproduce garbage.
Julio, right before I came here, I read this article that said the middle class, 22 million families, have been decimated by this recession because most of their wealth was in their homes and they weren't invested in the stock market so much. But also, the stock market has actually been performing very well. So those individuals that have had stocks, their wealth has just exploded, as have these corporations that are selling many things abroad in different places. They're doing very well. How do you envision this progressing as a society? What's going to happen to the middle class? Do we need?
What can you follow up on that? And you try to answer your own question.
Oh.
I'm curious too. Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's a paradigm shift, like you said, because a lot of the middle class jobs seem to be disappearing. You have to be very extremely highly educated, or be in one of these corporations to do well economically. So basically, what's going to happen to this middle segment of society? Is there polarization going to continue? I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. I just thought it was curious.
Okay. Full disclosure. I have some of the questions and I have probably none of the answers,
no,
right? But I will tell you how we framed it here in a previous discussion, right? In the second session that we had last week, we said that one of those things that is most offensive to human beings is inequality.
Yeah.
Inequality. And, you know, social alienation then is not an equal opportunity kind of thing, right? There are some people who are highly alienated, who have nothing vested in the status quo, right? On the contrary, the status quo is just like oppressive to them, right? They are powerless, they are poor, they are, you know, unemployed, they are marginalized. But there are other people, there are different gradations. And now, how has the US progressed? Well, the US has progressed in the wrong direction, right? In the last, since the 1960s, I would say, 1970s, that process began. You know, they started to make a dent in ideas, right? The influence of, they applied a lot of resources, by the way, to shift this ideological center of gravity of the society to the right. Paul Krugman, in his book, what is the name of his book? One of the most recent ones.
Great Unraveling.
I'm not sure where he describes how, you know, all these right-wing think tanks were built and how, you know, money by these rich people was funneled to these think tanks in how to influence universities and all that. It was a very deliberate plan to shift the ideas of the country towards the right. And, you know, the belief that markets, you know, markets is the only way to go. People shouldn't try to negotiate their interests through the civic process or, you know, through collective institutions, etc. And accompanying that in the economy, also there was this tectonic shift, right, that polarization. The Harper's Index, I was just reading it the other day here at the library.
Wait, the current one?
No, I don't know the current one, but one of the Harper indexes, says growth rate of productivity since 70-something to the present, or to 2009 or 2010. And it said 100-something%. Growth of real wages over the same period, -6% or some -3% or something like that. So that means that, you know, productivity went like that, real wages, the part that goes to most people, was flat or actually declined over a period of several decades. So the gains from productivity went to the top. And so you have this large disparity. When you have this large disparity, any mechanism through which people negotiate their interests, be a political system or an economic system like markets, you know, because when you have a market transaction, I'm helping you, you're helping me, I'm giving you this, I'm taking this from you. But if we are at a very unequal initial state, then the end state is like computer people say it's gonna be garbage in, garbage out, right? Because we start from a position of disparity, we end up with probably an enhanced disparity. And the political system is just reflecting that. Yesterday I was relating to people here the anecdote about the Feingold McCain, you heard that, right? Or the people were here yesterday, right? That Antonin Scalia said water always flows down, you know, as his way of, you know, refuting the McCain-Feingold law, saying, you know, don't waste time trying to prevent big money from influencing politics, because it's big money is going to influence politics. So it's in all the areas of social life, these disparities are going to be become evident, and so that has to give one way or another. It's because the people at the bottom are going to experience such a disgust with the situation that we are going to react against it. And hopefully we react the right way, and that requires, you know, organizing and fighting collectively, etc. I think political struggle is required. Yeah, I think I got to the end of my time. So, thank you so very much for attending.
Thank you.